Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is April reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, July 11, 2020. Energy. Rig count sets 10th consecutive record low. Total declines by 5 for the week. By Mella McEwen. M. McEwen at MRT.com. Rigs continue to be idled across the nation, but the rate at which they're being laid down has slowed significantly. The weekly U.S. rig count, as reported by Baker Hughes, fell another 5 rigs to 258, the services company reported Friday. That's the 18th consecutive weekly decline and 10th consecutive record low since the company began keeping records in 1940. The U.S. rig count is 700 rigs, or 73%, below the 958 reported at this time a year ago. All 5 of the idled rigs were in Texas, which saw its rig count slump to 107, down from 456 from a year ago. The Houston Chronicle reported 2 rigs active in the Eagle Ford were idled, as was one in the Barnett Shale, one from outside the state's shale basins, and one in the Permian. New Mexico added 1 rig to 49 rigs for the week. The Permian Basin reported 125 rigs this last week, down 312 rigs from the 437 at work in the region last July, Baker Hughes reported. Eddy County, New Mexico, remains the most active in the Permian, continuing to report 30 rigs for another week. Lee County, New Mexico, followed with 19 rigs, up 1 from the previous week. Loving County was the 3rd most active with 15 rigs, down 1 from last week, and Martin County has 14 rigs, unchanged for the week. Midland County reported 10 rigs at work within county lines, down 1 for the week. Baker Hughes reported 181 rigs drilling for oil, the lowest since June 2009, Reuters reported, while rigs drilling for natural gas fell 1 to 75, tying the record low set a couple of weeks ago, according to reports reaching back to 1987. The Houston Chronicle reports the Haynesville Shale in East Texas and northern Louisiana has surpassed the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania as the most active region for natural gas drilling, with 33 rigs, compared to 27 in the Marcellus. Reuters quoted analysts as saying higher oil prices will encourage energy firms to slow rig count reductions and possibly start adding some units later this year. Energy. Oil prices end week with gain. Crude closes at $40.55. By Mella McEwen. M. McEwen at MRT.com. The COVID-19 pandemic continued to impact crude prices this week. West Texas Intermediate on the New York Mercantile Exchange gained 93 cents, or 24%, Friday to close at $40.55, but below Monday's close of $40.63 a barrel. Friday's increase also did not overcome the $1.28 loss reported Thursday. The posted price ended the week at $37 a barrel. Natural gas prices on the NYMEX rose 2.6 cents to $1.805 per MCF Friday, below Monday's close of $1.83 per MCF. Prices Friday were boosted by a report from Gilead Sciences that its remdesivir treatment for COVID-19 cut mortality risk by 62%, Bloomberg reported. But the news agency also quoted the International Energy Agency as saying rising cases around the world could derail the market's recovery. Unfortunately, what goes up must come down. Grant Schwartzwelder, president and owner of OTA Compression LLC, OTA Environmental and Chimark Systems, told the Reporter Telegram by email, "With companies bringing production back on and a large number of DUCs, the industry can quickly respond to price increases by adding supply. With that supply being added to a very sensitive demand situation, the commodity price can swing more freely and quickly. Not a good thing. It sure looks like that will be the case for a while." Bloomberg said crude has struggled to extend a recent rally as traders weigh fresh outbreaks of the virus, California, Texas, and Florida have recorded some of their biggest daily gains in cases and deaths this week. There's a growing risk that a resurgence will impede efforts to reopen the economy. While the IEA said demand should rebound sharply over the next 3 months as economic activity resumes, the agency also warned a flare-up of the virus, which is raging across several U.S. states and reemerging in Asia, is casting a shadow over the outlook, Bloomberg said. Even though U.S. oil prices are still down about 34% since the start of the year because of coronavirus demand destruction, U.S. crude futures have jumped 113% over the past 3 months on hopes that global economies will snap back as governments lift lockdowns. MCSO, shooting victim in stable condition, from staff reports. A man was in stable condition at Midland Memorial Hospital on Friday afternoon after a shooting incident Thursday night, according to a press release from the Midland County Sheriff's Office. Deputies responded to a shots fired call in South Midland County at about 10 p.m. Thursday. They found a male victim with gunshot wounds, according to the release. He was transported to MMH. The investigation is continuing. The release didn't provide additional details. This is the second shooting incident that occurred in Midland County in the past 4 days. Two Midland men were being held in Midland County Jail Friday in connection with a shooting that occurred Wednesday night, according to a previous Reporter Telegram article. Jarsavian D. Ingram and Damar D. Polk, both 19, each were charged with 3 counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, a second-degree felony. Each man's bond was set at $150,000. One victim was shot in the face and shoulder. Another victim was shot in the wrist, according to the previous article. The incident began after Ingram and Polk allegedly robbed another victim of 1 ounce of marijuana. The two victims attempted to go after Ingram and Polk, who shot at them from their vehicle, according to the article. The shootings occurred in the 500 block of Jackson Street. Economic toll. COVID causes temporary closure of downtown eatery, from staff reports. Pi Social has closed its doors temporarily because of the spike in the number of coronavirus cases in Midland County. The downtown restaurant closed and will test its staff for COVID-19, according to an Instagram post. The post stated Pi Social will reopen once they receive the staff's coronavirus results. Pi Social opened in mid-March, just before dine-in services at restaurants were shut down because of coronavirus concerns, according to a previous Reporter Telegram report. The menu has more than just pizza. It boasts beef sliders and pommes frites, cauliflower bites, garlic knots, and chicken wings. The pizza selection includes a pesto chicken pizza topped with arugula and burrata, as well as the rustic, which can be topped with a fried egg. Cauliflower crust is available for those who want a gluten-free option. Obituaries. Barbara Noland. Barbara Noland, 87, passed away on July 8, 2020, at Legacy Ranch Memory Care Facility. The most important part of Barbara was her relationship with Jesus Christ. She was a wonderful mother, grandmother, great-grandmother, sister, and aunt. She is the oldest of 6 amazing children who all have a deep love for each other. Barbara was a considerate, sweet, and loving person to everyone, and was often called a blessing all the way to her final days. Barbara is survived by a daughter, Sharon Williams, an ex-husband, Ward, a son, Mark Noland, and wife, Ruby, 9 grandchildren and 12 great-grandchildren and counting. Services will be held on Saturday, July 11, 2020, at 10 a.m. at Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home in Midland, Texas, with interment following at Rest Haven North Cemetery. Live streaming of the service is available at www.livestream.com/NPW. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Death Notices. Brenda Joyce Hawkins. Brenda Joyce Hawkins, 60, of Midland, passed away June 27, 2020, in Midland, Texas. Brenda was born on December 17, 1959, to Willie Mae Gamble in Midland, Texas. A memorial service in her honor will be held on Tuesday, July 14, 2020, at 10 a.m. at American Heritage Funeral Home in Midland. Arrangements by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory. L.E. Tenen. L.E. Tenen, Sr., 92 years old, died July 8, 2020, surrounded by his family and loved ones. Funeral services will be under the direction of Ellis Funeral Home.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Saturday, July 11th, 2020. Section A. 14th death reported at MCH by Michael Merlot. An 85-year-old woman died Friday afternoon from COVID-19 complications at Medical Center Hospital, MCH. An MCH press release detailed that the woman was from Kermit and had pre-existing conditions. She was reportedly admitted to MCH from home June 30th and was one of the two reported COVID-19 patients who died Friday at MCH. In another press release, MCH detailed that out of 631 positive cases, 43 are in the hospital, 13 are in the critical care unit, and 8 are on ventilators. 3 are in the CCU overflow unit, and those 3 are on ventilators. The remaining 27 patients are on the 7 central and 8 central floors. MCH reported that no persons under investigation are in the hospital and 460 tests are pending. Odessa Regional Medical Center President Stacy Brown reported that 210 patients have tested positive from the virus, 904 negative, and 85 tests are pending. Brown said that 19 patients are in the hospital and 10 of them are on ventilators. Brown said that 12 staff members are out on isolation from community exposure. Mayor David Turner spoke on Governor Greg Abbott's order to halt elective surgeries at hospitals, and both MCH and ORMC reported that they have not furloughed any employees. ORMC Chief Medical Officer Dr. Rohit Saravanan said that the halt to elective surgeries is going to play a huge part regarding the operations of the hospital. He said that a few staff from the operating rooms can be deployed into COVID-19 units, but they don't replace any of the staffing needs that we had before, Saravanan said. We are still trying to get staffing hired so we can cope with the surge, and our hope is that order doesn't stay on too long so we don't have to delay elective surgery, he said, adding that it's one of the major contributors to the hospital. MCH Chief Nursing Officer Kristen Timmons said that MCH is trying to train different MCH healthcare workers in a multitude of ways so they don't have to cut workers or furlough staff. The hospitals are becoming overwhelmed. We can put people in beds in hallways. It's the staff to care for them, she said, adding that waiting on travelers and people to come help is taxing from a staff perspective. No county or the health department representative was present during Friday's hospital briefing, but the Ector County Health Department website detailed that 1,829 total cases are in the county, 1,235 cases are confirmed positive, and 594 cases are probable positive. A county press release detailed that there are 1,019 active COVID-19 cases and 796 patients have recovered from the virus. The release also stated that this number does not reflect the most up-to-date data and that staff would update the ECHD website by 5 p.m. because the health department is working on getting new staff set up and moving around. The health department has been late on reporting their numbers by the 3 p.m. hospital briefings on multiple occasions since they changed their reporting from 5 days a week to 3. Multiple county representatives have previously said that ECHD is struggling to keep up with reporting due to high case numbers and untrained staff. Turner said he has not heard from Abbott regarding another lockdown if COVID-19 cases continue to overwhelm Midland and Odessa hospitals. He said that the statement was taken out of context and that neither Representative Brooks Landgraf and Midland Mayor Patrick Payton heard about a shutdown. Turner said it's concerning if local elected officials aren't being made aware of those potential decisions and that he would reach out to Abbott next week. After the hospital briefing, the Texas Tribune ran a story about Abbott considering a potential lockdown as the next step in COVID-19 prevention. Turner also said that the city has received complaints regarding local entertainment venues, and that he will send Odessa Fire Rescue to investigate such venues and see if they are following mask and occupancy requirements. In other COVID-19 news, MCH President and CEO Russell Tippin said that the state will stop paying for remdesivir for hospitals, and if hospitals want the drug, they will have to pay for it themselves. Abbott announced Friday that Omnicare, a CVS company, is partnering with the state to provide testing of nursing homes and assisted living facilities, which would include on-site same-day testing and results for both facility staff and their residents. Testing in assisted living facilities reportedly began Thursday, and Omnicare will begin testing nursing homes next week, the release detailed. The Texas Tribune article can be located at tinyurl.com/y7j5nzf9. Local and state news roundup. ECSO searching for man connected to travel trailer theft. The Ector County Sheriff's Office, ECSO, is reportedly looking for the man involved in a theft of a travel trailer. The reported theft happened at 4 p.m. June 5th in the 4200 block of West University Boulevard, ECSO press release detailed. A white and tan 2010 Crossroad Sunset trailer with a 24-foot additional travel trailer, which was valued at $10,000, was reportedly stolen. ECSO believes a maroon Ford F-150 pickup truck backed up to the trailer and a man wearing a yellow shirt, black shorts, boots, and a white hat, hard hat, exited the vehicle. The man walked around the back side of the truck and over to the passenger side of the trailer and began to lower it down onto the truck, the press release stated. The man got back into the driver's side of the truck and drove away without disconnecting anything from the trailer. Anyone with information about the theft, contact Deputy Radel at the Ector County Sheriff's Office, 432-335-3050. Obituary and death notices for Saturday, July 11th. Rayanne Ruth Severson. Rayanne Ruth Severson, 17, died in a tragic car accident in Odessa, July 7th. She is survived by her parents, Chad and Sharon Severson, and a brother, Randy, of Odessa, grandparents, Jay and Penny Newbold of Mesquite, Nevada, Wesley and Becky Severson of Eagle River, Alaska, Aunt Jamie Green and husband Scott and her cousins, Aunt Rebecca Banfield and her husband Ed and cousins, Uncle Sean and Aunt Autumn Severson and cousins. Rayanne was born in Anchorage, Alaska, November 20th, 2002. A celebration of Rayanne's life will be celebrated Sunday, July 12th at Sherwood Baptist Church at 4 p.m., officiated by Pastor Harry Irwin. In lieu of flowers, we ask you to send donations to Sherwood Baptist Church, Panama Orphanage Ministry. Death notices. Juanita Hernandez Banuelos. Juanita Hernandez Banuelos, 88, died Wednesday, July 8th in Odessa. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Douglas Wayne Day. Douglas Wayne Doug Day, 66, of Lake Buchanan, died Wednesday, July 1st. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are by Clements Wilcox Funeral Home of Marble Falls.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Sunday, July 12th, 2020. Section A. SBA. 600 Midland businesses receive PPF funds. By Caitlin Randall, CRANDLE, at MRT.com. More than 600 businesses in Midland received $150,000 or more from the federal government's Paycheck Protection Program, according to data released by the Small Business Administration, with some of the largest recipients being oil companies, restaurants, and schools. Businesses that benefited from the program used their loans to retain more than 25,000 jobs, according to the data. They will not be required to pay back the funding they borrowed. Instead, the loans will be paid with taxpayer money. The number of jobs saved is nearly equal to the 22,000 jobs lost between March and April, when Midland's unemployment rate rose to 10%, according to a previous Reporter Telegram article. The oil and gas industry received the most loans of any sector, with 222 companies receiving funding for more than 8,000 employees' salaries. Of those companies, four, Blackline Energy, Imperative Chemical Partners, Integrity Services, and Wildcat Oil Tools, received loans between $5 million and $10 million. Some businesses did not use their loans to retain employees despite receiving substantial funding. Aggie Tech Energy Services, an oil field equipment supplier, received a loan between $2 and $5 million, but indicated the money was not used to save any jobs. The Paycheck Protection Plan, intended to help small businesses affected by the pandemic keep their workers employed, has loaned more than $520 billion to nearly 5 million businesses nationwide. Data released by the Small Business Administration does not include all businesses that received funding. The administration did not release data for businesses receiving loans less than $150,000, which means the identities of 85% of borrowers are unknown. Another benefactor of the program was Midland's restaurant and hospitality industry, which used loans to save 2,500 jobs, according to the data. Local restaurants such as KD's Barbecue and Venezia received funding, as did some national franchises, including Sonic and Domino's Pizza. Six private schools also borrowed money from the program. Midland Christian School and Trinity School received loans between $1 and $2 million. Midland Classical Academy borrowed between $350,000 and $1 million. And Hillcrest School and Hillander School borrowed between $150,000 and $350,000. The loans businesses received are presented in the data as ranges. For example, a business that received a loan between $1 and $2 million had the option to borrow an amount between those two numbers. The deadline to receive PPP loans, originally set for the end of June, was extended by Congress until August 8th, with about $140 billion in loans still available. City. Cases for the week breaks record by 39%. By Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N, at HurstNP.com. The total number of cases in Midland County last week not only reached 300 for the first time, but it was more than the previous high for a week by 39%. The 335 cases were a dramatic increase compared to last week's total of 209, but were nearly 100 more than the previous high of 241. The week also proved to be troubling as community transmission became the number one source of exposure inside Midland County for the first time. Community transmission made up 182 of the 385 cases, or 54%. The number of cases and cases' impact on hospitals caused local leaders to call for Midlanders to put on their masks and change their behaviors to allow the number of cases to drop to levels experienced in March and April. Before June 1st, the total number of cases was 129. Since then, the Midland Health Department has reported 975. The four deaths related to coronavirus complications also were the most since the beginning of June. Officials also reported larger jump in recovered cases this past week. Health Department officials reported an increase of 201 to 370, a jump of 118%. Health Department officials citing the Department of State Health Services also reported 7,934 total tests have taken place involving Midland County residents. Lee Graduate, former Railroad Commissioner, calls for name change. By Stuart Doreen, S-D-O-R-E-E-N, at HearstNP.com. A former Railroad Commissioner and a graduate of Robert E. Lee High School is joining the thousands calling for a name change. Michael Williams, a Republican who won statewide election to the Railroad Commission of Texas in 2000, 2002, and 2008, told the Reporter-Telegram that the renaming of Robert E. Lee High School is about offering a life story that we want to foster in the next generation of Midlanders. Is Robert E. Lee someone whose life story you want to celebrate in 2020-21? Williams said. I say no. The 1971 graduate recalled fond memories with his classmates that still considers friends today. He talked about being Lee's student body vice president, Mr. Valuable, and a good athlete. That doesn't deflect from that I didn't enjoy being a Lee rebel, Williams said, noting that as a student, he intentionally arrived late to student assemblies so he wouldn't have to stand for Dixie. Thankfully, students don't have to stand for that wretched song, Williams said, speaking for the decision to take Dixie out of the school's fight song. There is a petition at change.org calling for changing the name of Lee High School. As of Friday afternoon, 9,600 people had supported the petition. Williams, who also was head of the Texas Education Agency, said he doesn't buy the argument that changing the high school's name would be erasing history. Just like Midlanders didn't erase history when Carver High School was closed. He called for Robert E. Lee to be remembered in museums and books, not on buildings inside multi-ethnical communities. Do we want to celebrate that man and his life? Williams said. Do I want to celebrate his role in the Civil War? No. Williams' father, Johnny Williams, was a football coach at Carver High School and then an assistant coach at Midland High and Robert E. Lee High School. It is ironic in 1968 we Midlanders closed a school, Carver High School. Was that erasing history? Williams said. We closed a whole school, put kids on buses, and moved to the four corners of the community. Williams also talked about the timing of naming Robert E. Lee High School in Midland back when Midland ISD was segregated. Williams said there were two periods of American history when Confederate iconography was placed in the public domain. The first was between 1900 and 1920, when leaders across the country enacted Jim Crow laws to disenfranchise African Americans and segregate society. He said the second time period was in the 1950s and 60s, following the Supreme Court's landmark decision, Brown versus the Board of Education. Robert E. Lee High School in Midland was opened in 1961. Robert E. Lee High School in Tyler and San Antonio opened in 1958, and Robert E. Lee High School in Houston opened in 1962. A Robert E. Lee High School in Baytown was opened in the 1920s. Think about the timing, Williams said. Williams was Williams was, according to his biography on the University of North Texas Dallas website, where he is listed as a distinguished leader in residence, is the first African American to hold a statewide elected executive position in Texas. Williams served on the Texas Railroad Commission from 1999 to 2003, and again from 2007 to 2009, and at one point served as chairman. President George H.W. Bush appointed Williams Assistant Secretary of Education for Civil Rights in 1990. Williams began his career in Midland, where he was an assistant district attorney. He then served as a federal prosecutor and as special assistant to Attorney General Richard Thornburg from 1998 to 1999. Williams joins Eric Winston, a 2002 graduate and former president of the NFL Players Association, in voicing his support for the name change at Robert E. Lee High School. It's time to make a wrong, to right a wrong that we have let go for too long, Winston wrote in an opinion article for Reporter Telegram in June. We must change the name of Robert E. Lee High School. We cannot let his name remain on an establishment that welcomes students of all races, knowing he fought to keep so many of them in chains. Midland ISD Board President Rick Davis wrote the following about the petition to rename Robert E. Lee High School in Midland. The board understands the sensitivity of this issue and is continuing to listen to this community's differing views on it. Meanwhile, I believe that all members of this community are united in wanting us to continue to focus our time and efforts in improving the educational environment, resources, and outcomes for all students.
Obituaries. Arlene L. Horn. Arlene L. Horn, 84, of Odessa, Texas, went to be with her Lord on July 7, 2020. She was truly a virtuous woman of God and gave God all the glory for her life. She was a founding member of the Disciples of Grace Church in Odessa, Texas, founded in 2012. Arlene was born November 26, 1935. Her proud parents were the late Andreas and Lucille Backlig of Hilo, Hawaii. Arlene graduated from Hilo High School in 1953 and completed her first 2 years of college studies at the University of Hawaii in Hilo, Hawaii. In 1955, she transferred to the College of the Pacific in Stockton, California, to major in music and minor in business management. She was an active member of the Zeta Phi sorority and was the first to volunteer for many successful fundraising endeavors. Arlene grew up in a talented musical family. Her father, Andres, started the family dance band, the Royal Islanders of Hilo. She was an accomplished pianist, which served her and many musicians well for many years. She played the saxophone and accompanied her father on the violin or any instrument of his choosing. She accompanied her mother, Lucille, who sang with a mezzo-soprano voice that mesmerized audiences with her passion for life. The family band played at numerous Hawaiian celebrations, dances, weddings, and more. Arlene served as the pianist and organist for churches she attended throughout her life. Arlene married in 1958 and immediately started a family. By Christmas 1961, she had three babies, all in diapers. Daryl came first, Robin just 11 months later, and sweet Dawn Arlene. In March 1963, a family tragedy occurred when little Dawn was killed in a car accident. In October 1964, Arlene gave birth to our special little girl. Arlene said that God gave her a special child in place of the one she lost, and she appropriately named her Angela, her very own little angel. In the spring of 1966, on April 13th, Arlene's bouquet of children was made complete with the arrival of Leilani Michelle. Arlene took great joy in her children and delight in sharing her love of music. Music was always playing in the house. She taught her children to sing and encouraged her oldest, Daryl and Robin, to sing for Jesus in church. Learning to play a musical instrument was something she strongly encouraged. Her children learned to play the French horn, trumpet, tuba, piano, organ, and a very passionate tambourine. One of the highlights of Arlene's musical career was being invited to sing and open the Happy Goodman's concert, December 16, 1975, at the Ector County Coliseum in Odessa, Texas. Her voice was always strong and full of passion, moving many to tears. Arlene was also a professional businesswoman. Her professional positions consisted of Secretary to the Navy Commander at Lompoc Air Force Base in Lompoc, California. Accountant for general constructors and medical transcribing for the local hospitals. Medical transcribing was where she found her niche. Learning medical terminology came easy to Arlene, and she excelled at transcribing. She soon learned that transcribing dictation for foreign doctors paid more money. Therefore, she was determined to learn each physician's individual dialect. She became known as the Medical Transcriptionist Dictation Specialist. Arlene enjoyed a long, prosperous career in medical transcribing. She retired from Medical Center Hospital in Odessa, Texas, as well as Midland Memorial Hospital in Midland, Texas. After retiring, she needed to keep busy, and what better way than to describe something she enjoyed so much. Arlene worked from home transcribing for Medical Home Health and other national transcribing services from 1993 to 2012, when she officially retired. Arlene was preceded in death by her grandparents, Frank and Gloria Camara of Hilo, Hawaii, her parents, Andreas and Lucille Backlid of Hilo, Hawaii, and a daughter, Dawn Arlene Horn, Odessa, Texas. Arlene is survived by her children, Daryl, Joseph, deceased, Robin, Cecilia, both from Odessa, Angela from Midland, and Leilani Michelle from Dallas, Texas. Three grandchildren, Quentin, Brooke, Monique, and Kay Ali'i, and three great-grandchildren, Destiny, Isaiah, and Little Miss Aria. Siblings include sister, Carol Bison, brothers, Andres Backlid Jr., Rosemarie, and father, Timothy Backlid, better known as her little baby brother, Lionel. Beloved cousins, Clytel Kaiser and Andy Oppo. Many beloved nieces, nephews, grand-nieces, and grand-nephews. To my dearly beloved, until we meet again, aloha. Arlene Horn. In lieu of flowers, please send donations to Disciples of Grace Church, P.O. Box 13381, Odessa, Texas, 79768. Barbara June Broom White. Barbara June Broom White, 87, passed away peacefully on July 4, 2020 in Midland, Texas. Services will be held on Saturday, July 18, 2020 at the First United Methodist Church in Jal, New Mexico. Interment will follow at the Jal Cemetery under the direction of McCoy Funeral Home. Barbara is survived by two daughters, Linda Petix Sarandrea of the Woodlands, Texas, and Patricia Petix Shanks of Jal, New Mexico. One son, Peter Anthony Petix, deceased. Two stepdaughters, Barbara Ann Stooksberry of Midland, Texas, and Janet Betis of Batesville, Arkansas. Two grandchildren, Jason Nichols and Rodney Shanks, and one great-grandchild, Maddox, Anthony Nichols. She is also survived by one brother, Donald Broom of Eastland, Texas. Barbara was born on July 8, 1932, in Falls County, Texas, to Morris William Broom and Antonia Maria Nawara. In 1952, she married Santo Anthony Petix and returned to New York City to raise a family. She remains a beloved member of Santo's family and to this day is remembered dearly as Aunt Bobby. She returned to New Mexico in 1978, where she met Calvin White, Jr., and on November 4, 1979, in Las Vegas, Nevada, Barbara and Calvin were married. Together, they lived the happiest years of their lives until Calvin's passing on May 31, 2000. Barbara was a bright light and loved by all that she encountered. She was creative, fun, caring, giving to a fault, loved golf, and was a great cook. She will be dearly missed by all who knew her coast to coast. Barbara spent her final years at the Manor Park Younger Center in Midland, Texas, 2208 North Loop 250 West. In lieu of flowers, the family kindly requests donations be made to the Manor Park Endowment Fund in memory of Barbara. Online condolences may be expressed at www.mccoyfh.com. Brent Coleman. Brent J. Coleman died as a result of a stroke on June 29, 2020, in Midland, Texas. He was 68. The third of five children of George and Emmeline, known as Val Coleman, Brent was born on May 27, 1952, in Talara, Peru, where his dad, a petroleum engineer, was working with Esso's International Petroleum Operation. Talara was an idyllic setting for Brent and the athletic, active, and social Coleman family. There, Esso, now Exxon, built a company enclave populated by a diverse collection of oil expatriates from many ports of call. Living in the desert on the Pacific coast, the kids and Talera could be described as free-range children, fishing, swimming, horseback riding, all the while learning to treasure nature, to be self-reliant and mutually supportive, and to appreciate local culture. Brent appreciated and held close to his childhood in Talera for the rest of his life. After Peru, the Colemans roamed from Venezuela to Australia and then to Japan, with postings as well in Denmark and Guatemala, finally roosting for many happy years by the bay in Key Biscayne, Florida. Brent, in the meantime, earned his undergraduate degree, an M.S. in biochemistry, and then a medical degree. After his academic training, Brent served for a number of years as a reserve officer with the United States Navy Medical Corps, ultimately attaining the rank of lieutenant commander. Always visiting Key Biscayne and family, he pursued a career first as a trauma doctor and then as a small-town doctor in South Padre Island. He was dedicated to a holistic approach to health and making healthcare work for his patients, whatever the state of their insurance coverage or personal resources might have been. Later, he moved to Alpine and then finally to Midland, following the love of his life, Brenda Iskra, to her hometown. Brent is best understood by how he lived. He was one of those uncommon souls who created his life experiences on his own terms. Lofty and uncompromising, with himself and his values, he charted his own path. He was something of a paradox. He was at once robust and self-effacing, erupting with varied enthusiasms, tempered by a gentlemanly demeanor. Inwardly, he was deeply thoughtful and reverent. As much as he craved adventure, philosophy, literature, poetry, and music were his wellsprings. He was a serious autodidact, constantly cultivating his interests and spiritual nourishment, spending much of his time writing poetry, novels, and music. In recent years, he found high purpose in teaching at Midland College, where he valued his colleagues and derived much satisfaction in helping a new generation become EMT and paramedic certified. But his most salient characteristic to those who knew him well, the one that elicited the most spontaneous commentary when he suddenly became ill, was his fundamental goodness and generosity. He felt deeply the beauty in people as well as in nature. He always cared for others, whether a wounded bird or orphaned fox, or a friend in need. Always ready with a helping and, if needed, protective hand, always mindful of others, he embraced people in all circumstances with friendliness, compassion, and kindness. Always making others feel special. His loving family and friends take solace in the knowledge that he was essentially a contented man who made a positive difference in many people's lives. With gratitude for his good and loving nature, he is survived and mourned by his many friends and his beloved Brenda, her son Zach and his family, his siblings Carol, Tor, Dean, Connie, Gina, Frank, and Mark, his nephews and niece Alexander, Ryan, Nick, and Kaylin, their spouses and fiancés Lizzie, Steph, and Carrie, grandnephews Coleman, Fraser, and Harrison, and a large crop of cousins. When public health considerations enable safe travel and gatherings, family and friends will meet in Midland for a celebration of life. The date and place will be announced. Then, according to Brent's wishes, his mortal remains will repose with nature within an area around Big Bend National Park that he treasured. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Chloe Pamela Stone Chacho. If you knew Pam like we knew Pam, oh, what a girl. It is with a broken heart that the Chacho and Stone family say our dear, sweet Pam left us on July 1, 2020. She also left a legacy of rich memories, happy times, and many special and creative accomplishments. Oh, what a girl. Our dear Pam will live in our hearts forever. In addition to her husband, Jack Chacho, survivors include her daughter, Christian Chacho Briggs, and husband, Paul Briggs, and grandchildren, Leo and Luke Briggs, all of Glendale, California. Her son, Jacques Z. Chacho, Houston, Texas. Siblings are Jerry Stone Jr., Sue LaVon Stone, Cindy Stone Bordofsky, and Sandy Stone Fuglar. Pam was preceded in death by her parents, Sue LaVon and Robert Jerry Stone Sr., and by her brother, Nash Stone. Link to Pam's Dignity Memorial page, https://www.dignitymemorial.com/obituaries /924-5743. A memorial service will be held at a future date. In lieu of flowers, send donations to the Pancreatic Cancer Action Network. http://support.pancan.org/goto/pamchacho. Ramon Leyba. Ramon Leyba, Jr., 51, of Midland, passed away July 4, 2020. A visitation will be held 4 to 9 p.m. on Monday, July 13, at Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory. Live stream of the visitation can be viewed by going to www.npwelch.com. Funeral services will be held 1 p.m. Tuesday, July 14, 2020, at Elevate Church in Midland. A live stream of the service can be viewed at livestream.com/Elevate Church Midland. Burial will follow at Rest Haven Memorial Park. Ramon was born on June 27, 1969, in Odessa, Texas, to Ramon Leyba Sr. and Angie Garza. He was a man full of life who was always giving his time, his prayers, and his money to anyone who needed help. He started the Feed the Truck Drivers on I-20 this last spring. He was always making people laugh. He didn't know a stranger. He loved sports and played football and baseball. He loved his Dallas Cowboys. He went to Hobbs High School, Hobbs, New Mexico, and Tulare High School in Tulare, California in the mid-80s. He had a heart of gold. He loved his wife, Deborah, like the first day he loved her, so strong and caring for her and all their children. Ramon is survived by his wife, Deborah, their children, Anissa, Christopher Jeremy, and wife Brittany Rodriguez, Paul Lara Jr., Alexander and wife Giovanna Sanchez, Anthony Sanchez, Andrea Sanchez, and his grandchildren, Bella, Ellie, Kylie, Nilaya, Hyalin, Emery, Giovanni, Alexavier, Alea, Joel, and Christopher. His parents, Ramon Leyba and Evangelina Leyba. His brothers, Robert and wife Roxanne Leyba, Ray Leyba, and his favorite sister Evelyn Leyba and Mo Herrera, and numerous nieces, nephews, and great-nieces and nephews, aunts and uncles. Ramon is preceded in death by his twin brother Roman Leyba, his paternal grandmother Rafaela Lozoya, maternal grandmother Enriqueta Garza, aunts, uncles, and cousins. The family would like to express their gratitude towards everyone who has called, texted, prayed, and donated to the family. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Questions about death notices or online guest books? Email to obits@mrt.com.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Odessa American for Sunday, July 12th, 2020, Section A. Setting OC's bar high. President loves the challenge. By Bob Campbell. There are 1,462 community colleges in the nation. And if anyone wonders why Odessa College should aspire to be number one, Gregory D. Greg Williams is quick to answer, why not? OC president since 2007, the 55-year-old Tyler native came here with his family in the late 1960s, excelled in academics and sports at Ector High, and graduated from Permian High in 1983 after EHS was closed. His parents, Willie, a machinist, and mother, Ruby, pushed him and his three brothers and sister to do their best in everything. My mom took care of the basic courses, while my dad took care of the conduct grade, said Williams with a chuckle. We had to perform and do well and treat others the way we wanted to be treated. They made a wonderful combination. Williams' father died when he was 13, and he survived that trauma to study at OC for 1.5 years and finish his bachelor's at UTPB in another 1.5 years, with a major in psychology and a minor in history and a teaching certification. He earned his master's in psychology and educational mid-management at UTPB and his education doctorate in psychology and educational leadership at Baylor. Asked why he wanted to return to OC after serving as Dean of Students at Amarillo College, Vice President of Student Services at Midland College, and President of Western Texas College in Snyder, Williams said, "Everything about it appealed to me, the good people, the smart people who were so dedicated and phenomenal. I loved the culture, the students who attended, and the people who wanted to make a difference in the lives of students who were trying to have better lives and find a career. We want to be the best community college in the nation and lift all boats at colleges all over the nation, reaching out and sharing what we're doing with students' outcomes. We're getting closer and closer. We are enrolling and graduating more people than ever. I'm driven by the relentless pursuit of excellence." Williams had previously taught history and coached at Burleson Elementary and Ector Junior High, served as assistant principal at Travis Elementary, and taught psychology at OC, where he was also dean of enrollment management. He and his wife Karen have three children. Williams' participation in the 1991 Leadership Odessa class further lifted the level of his ambition, and as he went on to good jobs in other places, his hometown memories grew sharper and his ideas about the potential of its namesake college clearer. "We need to improve our completion and graduation rates and help more people acquire the basic skills they might not have had when they left high school," he said. "They need more technical skills than ever before in order to make a nice living. College is becoming more and more important." Lorraine Perryman, chair of the Executive Board of the Education Partnership of the Permian Basin, said Williams is a perfect example of what the leadership of one person will do to transform an organization. "Greg was and is the right person at the right time," Perryman said. "He has the vision and the ability to communicate that vision to the community, get the right people on board, and make his vision a reality. He took Odessa College from being a sleepy little community college that had not asked the community to support it and helped pass a 2010 bond election with 66% approval to make the capital improvements it needed." Adding that Williams is a good family man, Perryman said, "It is 100% because of his leadership that OC has become one of the top community colleges in the nation." As a hometown guy, there was no learning curve for Greg. He hit the ground running. ECISD School Board Trustee Steve Brown, a former Permian principal, said OC and Odessa have certainly benefited from his commitment to the college and our community. "He is a super guy with great character, very honest," Brown said. "I've known him since he was a teacher and coach at Ector Junior High in the late 1980s. He has high expectations for himself, and that transfers to any organization he's associated with. He is a great fellow who is respected in Odessa as well as in the state and nation. When you look at what he has accomplished at OC, it's phenomenal." Jeff Melton, Assistant Dean of Development at McCombs School of Business at the University of Texas in Austin, was at Permian with Williams and was in their 1991 Leadership Odessa class. "I was struck by how unbelievably smart he was," Melton said. "He was the assistant principal at Travis Elementary, and when I saw how the kids gravitated to him with big smiles on their faces, I thought, this guy is a born educator. He listens to people, takes in what they have to say, and builds a consensus. The cream rises to the top when times are tough, and Greg always has." While OC was a top 10 finalist for the prestigious Aspen Prize in 2017 and 19, earning the Washington-based Aspen Institute's Rising Star Award, it still faces the laborious task of raising the overall educational level of a working class city and area where higher education is often an afterthought, Williams said. The high schools continue to evolve and offer more and more to students, he said. Certain students are getting out and doing really well, but some are not because they didn't realize the need to be there. Our job is to meet them where they are and improve the outcome because more is expected of them than ever before. Education is an art as well as a science. Kept in town lately by COVID-19, Williams ordinarily travels 20 weekdays a year, mostly to Washington and Austin. I drive a lot, he said. Austin is my second home. He was honored in 2016 for the OC trustees to name the college's new continuing education building, Dr. Gregory D. Williams Hall, but he is more impressed with the job at hand. I'm thankful because the trustees have been very supportive, but I don't think about the building or any of those kinds of things, he said. I think about what I can do to make OC better. I love what I do.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.